This is going to be a part history, part Torah, and hopefully we'll see how the history of Bar Kokhba and some aspects of Sukkot intersect, and in fact something about Bar Kokhba could teach us a lesson about Sukkot that's already found in our own Makaros, if it's already found in Chazal and later Rishonim and Achronim, but it comes to life much more when you see it in real life in the historical sources. So of course, before we get to the Sukkot part, I just wanted to give a little bit of a background, an overview into Bar Kokhba. What the revolt was all about, what happened, and what the precipitants were, and what the effects were. So I should have given you a timeline. I'm learning timelines are very important. But does anybody know around the time when the Romans first came into Eretz Israel? Is it around the year? Yeah, Shana? Close? It's a little bit before. 63 BCE is the date given for when the Romans officially took over Eretz Israel. Anybody know how the Romans took over Eretz Israel? It's an interesting story. We're 100 years into 100 years after the Hanukkah story, 100 years after the Hanukkah miracle. The Hashemite dynasty has had many ups and downs over the course of that time, but they're doing pretty well for themselves, being a small country among other superpowers, until various things started happening internally. Around the year, a little bit before 63 BCE, when the Romans came in and took over, there was the Hashemite king had passed away, and he left two children, Aristobulus and Hyrcanus. You might have heard of these people from Gemara Shir and from history classes. Very often, when there are two brothers left to take the throne, there's going to be a civil war. This is a civil war that the Gemara discusses in a couple of places between Aristobulus and Hyrcanus, the two Hashemite brothers. If you remember the story with one of the families being within the walls of Yerushalayim, the other family being outside the wall of Yerushalayim, and them lowering chests full of gold, and the people on the outside raising up sheep for the Karban Tamid, until one time a pig was raised instead of a sheep. That story was said about this war, about the civil war between Aristobulus and Hyrcanus, the two Hashemite brothers. What do you do if there's a stalemate in a civil war? One side looks for external support. The Romans had just taken over Syria, which is directly north of Eretz Israel. Pompey was the great Roman general who just defeated the Greek Seleucid Empire. He was sitting in Syria. Hyrcanus, the weaker of the brothers, sent messengers to Pompey asking for external support, asking for Roman support in the civil war. What did the Romans do? They came in. They marched in peacefully. There was no war. They killed Aristobulus, took Aristobulus captive, killed his people. But into Jerusalem itself, they walked in peacefully. And they set up Hyrcanus as the Kohen Gadol, or something of that sort. I think it was a Kohen Gadol. And set up their own Roman person as the real political leader. And from 63 BCE and on, that's when the Romans took control over Eretz Israel, actually invited in by Jews. Interesting historical lesson, and sometimes Jews could be their own worst enemy. Romans were in charge of Eretz Israel for a little bit more than 100 years, and then we get to Korban Bayis Rishon. What happened is that from 63 BCE to 67 CE, we're talking about 120 years or so, Romans were in charge, there were ups, there were downs, sometimes better relationships, sometimes worse relationships. 67 CE, 120 years after the Romans come in, is the Mered HaGadol, the Great Revolt, that lasts for 3 years, that ends with the Korban Bayis Rishon. That ends with the Korban Bayis Sheni. Titus comes in, destroys the Mishnah, leaves, and everything is fine, but not so fine. The Romans are in charge some more. Around 60 years after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, in 132 CE, that's when Bar Kokhba leads the second great revolt against the Romans. What happened? We don't really know. We don't have so much historical data in terms of what was going on at the time. We don't know what exactly, precisely precipitated this revolt. Could have been economic issues, could have been religious persecution, could have been a whole variety of things. We have some sources, as we'll see in a second. But Bar Kokhba led basically a guerrilla revolt against the Romans, which was uncannily successful. Nobody expected Bar Kokhba to be successful. He was successful. He established his own mini-government. He freed Yerushalayim from the hands of the Romans. The revolt lasted for 3 years, much longer than the Romans initially expected. Emperor Hadrian, who was emperor at the time, had to call one of his elite generals back all the way from England, from Britain, who was fighting on the northernmost border of the Roman Empire, traveled all the way from Britain back to Eretz Israel. Back in the good old days, it was quite a journey. And I forgot the guy's name, but he was one of the elite Roman generals at the time. He was the one who led the Roman effort to take apart Bar Kokhba. And then the effects of the Beit Har, as we see in our Roman Chronicles, was the last hold. The Roman generals besieged Beit Har for several years. Beit Har finally fell. Bar Kokhba and all of his people were killed. The effects of this revolt were massive. If anybody ever wondered where the term Palestine comes from, it comes from Emperor Hadrian's renaming Judea after this revolt. He was so ticked off, so annoyed with the Jews, that he changed the name of the province from Judea to Palestine, based on the ancient Plishtim, Philistines, and he basically made it a southern part of the Syrian province. So he literally changed the name of the country, changed the name of the province, because he was so annoyed at the Jewish revolt. Religious persecutions were en masse afterwards. The Gemara tells us that Hadrian Aser Talmud Torah. He prohibited people to learn Torah, he prohibited Bris Milah, prohibited a lot of things. He basically decimated the entire Jewish community in the Yehuda area, in Judea area, the southern area of Israel where we are now. And this is a time period when the center of Jewish life moved from the south to the north to the Galil. Asar HaRugi Malkus, the people we read about on Yom Kippur yesterday, some of them, Rabbi Kiva included, were killed post Bar Kokhba revolt for Rabbi Kiva, presumably because he was part of the revolt. Let's just read a little bit what we have from historical sources, from a Roman source, then we'll look at Talmud Yerushalmi. We'll see what the Romans tell us about the revolt, we'll see what Chazal tell us about the revolt, and then we'll go from there to see how the revolt connects to Sukkot. Does somebody want to read source number one? This is Cassio Dio. He was a Roman historian, died in 235, so he's around 100 years after the revolt. Does somebody want to read out loud? Very loud? If not, I can do it. What's her name? Sarah, please. Loud, please. Right, so according to this Roman source, we don't know if this is true or not, Hadrian decimated Yerushalayim, rebuilt it as Aela Capitolonia, as a Roman city, prior to the revolt, and that's what motivated the revolt. More recent historical scholars say there's no proof for this, maybe they think he did it afterwards as a punishment, but either way, that's what this Roman historian thought. Go on, please. Right, so Hadrian was traveling through the area, which he was. Hadrian was known as an emperor who traveled a lot. He traveled to Britain, traveled to all the corners of his realm. He traveled through Eretz Israel. When he left, that's when the revolt took place. Please go on. So they didn't want to fight the Romans in the open field. What did they do, rather? Has anybody here been to the Bar Kokhba caves? You guys will probably go soon. That's exactly what they did. They dug out these caves. This is a picture of somebody inside a Bar Kokhba cave. They made sure there were some holes for air. They made sure there were some holes for light. They camped out in these caves, and they guerrilla warfare, they attacked the Romans piecemeal, piece by piece. Now, one paragraph about the result of the war. So nobody really knows what the Tomb of Solomon is. We don't know anything about Kever Shlomo. In fact, I even Googled it just to make sure it doesn't exist. And I got a Sha'ala Tarav, like Ask the Rabbi website. Somebody asked, is there such a thing as Kever Shlomo? And the response was no. So apparently it doesn't exist, at least as far as we know. But Judea was desolate. Jews moved either killed or moved out to the north. So just keep in mind what the Roman historian thought was important to tell us about Bar Kokhba. Now let's look at the main source that we have in Chazal about the Bar Kokhba War. Source number two, Yerushalmi in Ta'anis. We're going to go through it just for background about the war, and we'll get to Sukkot in around 10 minutes or so. Tani Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai taught. Rabbi Kiva he adoresh. Rabbi Kiva would darshan the following pasuk. Derach Kokhav Mi'akov. That that a star is going to shoot forth from Yaakov. This is a pasuk that's interpreted messianically about Mashiach. Darach Kuzva mi Yaakov. Kuzva, Shimon ben Kuziva, Bar Kokhba, was the person who was the fulfillment of this prophecy. How did he get the name Bar Kokhba in Jewish sources? Because of this. Darach Kochav mi Yaakov, the son of the star. Rabbi Akiva said the pasuk about the star was relevant for him. His real name was Bar Kuziva, Bar Kuziva, as we'll see from the sources. So Rabbi Akiva thought that Bar Kokhba was going to be Mashiach. Rabbi Akiva, next line, Kadhav Achami Bar Kuzva, when he saw Bar Kuzva, Hava Amar, he said, Dinhu Makla Mashika, this is Melech Mashiach. Amar li Rabbi Yochanan Metursa, Rabbi Yochanan Metursa said, Akiva, Yalu Asavin Bilachayach, grass is going to grow in your cheek, meaning you're going to be long dead, Vandayin Ben David Loba, and Mashiach is still not yet going to come. So we see that there was an internal debate among the Chachamim of the time whether and how to relate to Bar Kokhba. Was Bar Kokhba potential Mashiach? The Rambam says that Rabbi Akiva thought he was Bechezkas Mashiach. An interesting phrase, that he was presumed to be Mashiach until proven otherwise when he fell. And Rabbi Yochanan Bar Tursa, another Chacham at the time, said, you're being overeager, you're being too messianic. This is going to be a very slow, long galus and a very, very slow process of redemption. Good. So Rabbi Akiva definitely thought this was Mashiach potential. Starts in the middle of the next line. Amar Rav Yochanan. Shmonim elef zug shel tokei krenos hayu makifin es beitzar. There are 80,000 pairs of ram horn blowers who encircled beitzar, who besieged beitzar. Nechol echad ve'echad hayu mimuna al kama chayelos. And everyone was in charge of several soldiers. So we're talking about a huge Roman legion besieging beitzar. Vayesham ben Kuzva, and ben Kuzva, ben Kuziva, Bar Kokhba was inside. Vayelo matayim elef matifei etzba. He had 200,000 people whose thumbs were cut. Why are their thumbs cut? Anybody familiar with the story? He wanted to see who was the strongest. Shalcho chachamim, the chachamim sent, v'amrlo, an emasai ta'osa tshel balimumin. He would only accept people in his army if they were strong enough, strong-willed enough to cut off their thumbs. The Chachamim sent a messenger, or said themselves to Bar Kuziva, why are you making the Jews into Baal Imam? Why are you forcing them to inflict wounds upon themselves? Amar Lehen, Yechayek Ab Shagabatkan, how else can I test them to see if they are worthy of standing up in battle? Amar Lo, Komish Inu Roke Bosuso, V'okir Erez Min Lefanon, Lo Yenikta B'Israel Shalka. Great. Whoever can't ride on a horse and uproot a tree shouldn't be part of your army. So the Chachamim came up with another test to see who was going to be strong enough to be part of Bar Kokhba's army. What type of personality traits do you find in Bar Kokhba? Strong, courageous, very fierce,
violent.
Very violent. Sorry? Not so much a munash, and we'll see the rest. That's exactly the next line. So Hayulo Matayim Elef Kach, Matayim Elef Kach. He had 200,000 soldiers with their thumbs cut off, 200,000 soldiers who were able to uproot the tree. The Kach to have enough of the Kirva, when he would go out to battle, Hava Amar, he would say, Riboni Da'alma, master of the world, Lo Tis'od V'lo Tiksof. What do you think that means? Lo Tis'od V'lo Tiksof? Don't help us. V'lo Tiksof? Don't corrupt us. Don't mess us over. Halo atah Elokim zanachtanu v'lo tetzei b'tzevotenu. God, you abandon us and don't come out in our armies. Asking God to step away. So what impression do you get of Bar Kokhba?
Kind of like a heretic.
A little bit of a heretic. Very fierce, very nationalistic. He's listening to the Chachamim. He wants to prove himself. He is listening to the Chachamim. He has a good relationship with the Chachamim. He asked their advice, or at least when they gave him their advice, he listened to them. But he's very strong, very arrogant, very into his own strength and the strength of his soldiers. We're not going to read through the whole thing inside, but the Gemara says, how did Beitar fall? That there was one Tana in Beitar, Rabbi Lazar Hamodai, who was fasting and davening from the day Beitar was besieged, that Hashem shouldn't give Beitar over to the Romans. This person, Rabbi Lazar Hamodai, because he was davening so much, Hashem didn't let the Romans come in. The Roman generals, the Roman emperors, were about to leave. They've been there for 3 years. They're getting tired of the siege. One Kuti said, and this is a good story the Gemara tells, one Kuti said, let me sneak in, I'll be able to give you the city. The Kuti snuck in through a sewage pipe or something of that sort, through some hole in the wall. He goes over to Rabbi Elazar ben Modai as he's davening, and he whispers something in his ear. That's it. Walks away. He then lets himself get captured by Bar Kokhba soldiers. When Bar Kokhba is interrogating him, and people say this person was in contact with Rabbi Elazar ben Modai, Bar Kokhba interrogates him and says, What did you tell this Tana who's davening every day? First, he makes a big show. I don't really want to tell you. If the Roman general captures me, he's going to kill me. But if I don't tell you, you're going to kill me. So in the end, he tells him. He makes up a story that I was colluding with Rabbi Elazar HaModai to give over the city to the Romans. Bar Kokhba here says, doesn't give Rabbi Elazar HaModai his fair hearing in court, kicks him. Rabbi Elazar ben HaModai dies. That day, Beitar falls. Again, what type of picture are Chazal trying to tell us about Bar Kokhba? Impulsive, strong, arrogant, fiercely nationalistic. Somebody who was right to be Mashiach according to Rabbi Akiva. Again, we can't forget his positive traits. Nationalistic, presumably a Shomer Halakha. We're going to see historical documents tell us he kept Halakha. He kept all the details of Halakha as far as we know. But a little bit impulsive, a little bit arrogant, and according to Chazal, that's what lost him the war. Just before we get to the Sukkah stuff, what are the Romans interested when they're telling us history in the book called Roman History? Sorry? I mean, the Romans are interested in facts. They tell you what exactly happened. There was Hadrian passed through Eretz Israel. When he left, the Jews revolted. It was a guerrilla warfare. They dug out tunnels, dug out caves before. And he gives you blow by blow as much as he knows of the war until he describes the desolation afterwards. Chazal don't even tell us about the caves. What interests Chazal about the war of Bar Kokhba? This is true about almost every historical circumstance that Chazal described. Chazal aren't as interested in the facts. You can go to the Roman sources for that. Chazal are interested in teaching you the lessons that emerge from the facts, the lessons that emerge from the story. Over here, the lesson that emerges from the story is that you could be a big tzaddik, you could be very nationalistic, you could be charismatic, you could revolt against the Romans and want to rebuild Yerushalayim and the Beis HaMikdash. We'll see. He put the Beis HaMikdash on the coins he minted. But if you're a little bit arrogant, if you're a little bit impulsive, the entire thing is going to unravel, and you're going to end up being killed by the Romans, or being killed by a snake, as Bar Kokhba was. So it's just interesting difference to see how Chazal do history and how the Romans do history. Romans do history to tell you the facts, a little bit of propaganda, mostly the facts. But Chazal do history, it's always to teach you the lessons, the spiritual lessons that can emerge from the story. Good. Now that we did a little bit about the background of Bar Kokhba, let's see two places where Bar Kokhba intersects with Sukkahs. The first one is just interesting. The second one is going to give us a window into one of the lessons of Sukkahs. In these Bar Kokhba caves, they found lots of different artifacts. They found some fascinating stuff. Among the stuff they found was source number 3, Igros Bar Kokhba. That's Tavim Shel Bar Kokhba. They found letters. If you want to look at a picture, look at page number 3, turn the page. This is a fragment of a letter they found. You can see it's written in regular Hebrew, if it's color, you can actually make out the letters and make out the words, and it's pretty readable to the even to the average person. The language is Hebrew Aramaic. It's a mixture of Hebrew and Aramaic, but the letters are Ksav Ashuri, the same Hebrew letters that we have nowadays. So on the government website, they put up pieces or segments of these letters. I don't have access to an academic library anymore, so we couldn't actually look up full copies of the originals. But this is what's available online. So let's read through a couple of these, and we'll get to the one about Sukkos. Ketam Mispar Echad. This is the first letter they found in the Bar Kokhba caves. We'll read it on the top, and there's a translation in modern Hebrew on the bottom. Ve'esrin l'shvat, the 20th day of Shvat, shnat shtayim l'geulat Yisrael, aydei Shimon ben Kusiva, nasi Yisrael. This is the heading of a letter. The 20th day of Shvat, the second year of the redemption of the Jewish people, through Shimon ben Kusiva, nasi Yisrael. So what do you already see from the letter? Sorry? Yeah. he, or at least he refers himself as a leader. Not saying he's just a term for a leader. But the Gulat Yisrael, again, he's nationalistic. He's not doing this only for his own sake, for his own arrogance. He really cares. He apparently felt the great offense of having Romans taking over Eretz Yisrael. He wanted to lead a rebellion so Am Yisrael could be redeemed. And this is the beginning of a letter, and the letter continues. Look at letter, turn the page, look at letter number 2. This is the one about Sukkos. Let's read the top, and you can follow me in the Targum if you want, in the modern Hebrew. Shimon Yehuda bar Menashe the Kiryat Aravia. This is a letter from Shimon ben Koziva, bar Kokhba, to Yehuda bar Menashe, who lives in Kiryat Aravia, wherever that is. Shalachta lecha shrei chamarin. I sent you 2 donkeys. Tishlach imahen shrei gavrin. Send with those 2 donkeys 2 people. Levas Yonasan baba'inu levas misavlo diya amrun. With these 2 people, send these 2 people back with the donkeys. And why should you send back with the donkeys to the caves? Anybody want to guess?
Weapons, probably.
Look at the next line. A form of weapon, as we'll see. Vishachon machane levasach lulavin v'esrogin. Send to this cave, send to our camp, lulavs and esrogs. Apparently in Adasim and Aravos, they were able to find in the fields around. But they didn't have access to lulavim and esrogim in the caves. He sends out 2 donkeys to a nearby town, or somewhere down south, asking them, please send back donkeys filled with lulavs and esrogs. Oh, sorry. He deals with Hadassim and Rebos in the next line. And then send afterwards Hadassim and Rebos. Look at the last line of the letter. It's fascinating. V'takein yosoun. Fix them. What does it mean to fix the lulav and esrog? Anybody know what the Mishnah mean? When the Mishnah uses the word takein about fruit, what it refers to? Taking up trumas and maestros. The Mishnah tells us, an esrog shall tevel, if an esrog has not yet had trumas and maestros taken off from it, you can't use it for the mitzvah. The word takein, a fruit, in rabbinic Hebrew, in the language of the Mishnah, means to take off trumas and maestros. So apparently Bar Kokhba didn't want to have to deal with it. He wanted everything to be kosher before it got to him, in the kosher packages. So he asked the people, before you send it to us, make sure to take off trumos and maestros from the esrogim so that the esrogim should be kosher for usage and kosher for eating. What picture do you get about Bar Kokhba, Shimon Bar Kokhba? He's keeping halacha. He's from. He's an Asi Yisrael. He's Badakti Kalav Chamura. He's willing to risk men. He's willing to risk soldiers in order to allow his army to have enough lulav and esrogim for the mitzvah. I don't know if this teaches us anything about Sukkos, but I think it teaches us 2 interesting points. Number 1, Bar Kokhba is a very complicated figure. Chazal described him as somebody who's impulsive, arrogant, somebody who is heretical to a degree, who said, God, just leave us alone. But on the other hand, Rabbi Akiva thought he was Mashiach. And on the other hand, we have historical documents saying how frum he was, not just wanting to take lulav and esrog, but actually keeping the details of halakha, making sure that trumos and maestros were taken off before he had it. Did you see how complicated some of our historical figures are? B'cheskas Mashiach, B'dakti Kalaka Kamura, a great person, a hero, but still impulsive, arrogant, and that was ultimately his downfall. A very, very mixed legacy. And also just shows you what the Mesiras Nefesh of Jews was for mitzvos. Nowadays we just go walk in the streets anywhere in Yerushalayim we want, buy lulav and esrog. Jews were getting lulav and esrogim from themselves, even if it was at risk of their lives. I don't know if halachically they had to or not, but that's what they were doing. Yeah.
Why is he getting a lulav and esrog from Shvat?
Oh, I'm sorry. There were 2 different letters. The first letter was just a heading of a letter from Shvat. Yeah, this letter I don't know if it's dated, but at least it's presumably from somewhere around a little bit before the Sukkah season. If you just want to see the impulsive, arrogant, violent Bar Kokhba come out again, the third source, Ketam Mispar Gimel, is a letter Bar Kokhba sent to somebody, and he said, you know, you have to do what I say. If you don't do what I say, I'm going to chain up your legs like I did to your friend. So he was also violently threatening people with these letters, while at the same time, again, I don't know what the need was. Maybe it was necessary for the war effort. I don't know. But he was violently threatening people in these letters at the same time as he was trying to get love and this ribbon. This gives you a richer, real sense of the real person, who Bar Kokhba was as a person, what he meant to the people at the time, why he was such a conflicting, controversial figure at the time, and why he's still such a conflicting and controversial figure. But the real thing I wanted to get you, was the Bar Kokhba coins. Turn the page. Bar Kokhba, like any political leader at the time, minted coins as a sign, as a symbol for his government. This is one of the coins he minted. There are several of them. They found these in these caves as well. What do you see on the left-hand side of the coin? What's that a picture of? Beis HaMikdash. What's inside the Beis HaMikdash?
The Aron.
The Aron, exactly. So it's pretty clear what the war is after. The ultimate goal of this war is to regain Yerushalayim and have enough respite from the Roman attacks to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash and bring the Aron back to the Kodesh HaKadoshim. What's on the right side? Luv and Esrog. Otherwise, it wouldn't be Gim Shir. You're right, it's a Luv and Esrog. Right, the Esrog is in the bottom left. The Luv is the top. What's to the right and to the left of the Luv? Adas and Arava. Good. Let's just read the English. Again, I didn't have any real books, so I just got this off of a website, an ancient coins website. Does anybody want to read it? This coin? This oracle, thank you. Stop over there. Again, it says for the freedom of Jerusalem. Again, a figure who's from nationalistic, somebody who wants to redeem the Jewish people, somebody who wants to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash, and yet arrogant, impulsive, and violent, which ultimately was his downfall.
It is extremely...
Can we stop over there? Good. Anybody knows anything interesting about the Lulav? I'm sorry, why is it not like we have today? Okay, it's in some type of thing which binds it together. The Mishnah describes that the lulav hadas and rav are supposed to be tied together. Presumably, this was some ancient way of tying it. I honestly do not know.
Only one
hadas and one rav. Exactly. If he was so from, why didn't he have three hadasim and two aravas? That's the question. We're going to say this is a minor question. We'll get to the major point in a second. But what the lulav is doing on his coin in the first place. Why out of all the ceremonial items in Judaism, why choose a lulav to put on your coin? But there's only one hadas and one arava. So why is there only one hadas and one arava? So this is a speculation. But Rabbi Dr. Naftali Tzvi Berlin, Rabbi Meir Bar Ilan, who was the son of the Netziv, became a Zionist, moved to Israel, and Bar Ilan Street, Rehov Bar Ilan is named after him, in addition to Bar Ilan University. He wrote an article. We speculated the following. Look in source number 5. Mishnah Sukkah Paragimel Mishnah Dalet. This is a Mishnah that deals with how many of the Dalet Minim we need. Rabbi Yishmael Omer, Shlosha Adasim, Ushtei Aravos. Rabbi Yishmael says you need 3 Adasim and 2 Aravos. Lulav Akav, Esrog Akav. And 1 Lulav, 1 Esrog. That's all we do. Afilo shnayim ketumim ve'akarinu katam. Even if two of the dasim are cut off, one not cut off. Rabbi Tarfon Omer, afilo shlosha ketumim. Even if 3 of the dasim are cut off, it's fine. Good. Rabbi Shmuel says 3 of the dasim, 2 are rebels. Rabbi Akiva Omer. Rabbi Akiva says, kishim shelulav echad esrog echad, kach atas echad v'arava achas. Just like you only need 1 lulav and 1 esrog, you also only need 1 hadas and 1 arava. Anybody connecting to that? Who was Bar Kokhba a student of? Or who was part of Bar Kokhba's revolt? Rabbi Akiva. How many hadasim and aravos does Rabbi Akiva say you need? 1. Bar Kokhba's picture of lulav only has 1 hadas and 1 arava. Put all the dots together, Rabbi Akiva was probably the posek of Bar Kokhba's revolt, and therefore there's only 1 hadas and 1 arava, as opposed to we who pass in the Rabbi Shmuel, you need 3 hadasim and 2 aravos. That's how detailed the keeping of halacha gets in the Bar Kokhba revolt. Good. That's just more of a cool side point. The main issue is what in the world is the lulav doing there in the first place? And of all the ceremonies in Judaism, why would you choose a lulav on your coin that's supposed to represent your revolt against the Romans, your redemption of the Jewish people? Think of menorah. A menorah was on a lot of the Hashmonai coins. I don't know. It represents the victory over the Greeks. A lot of other symbols in Judaism we could have used. Why the lulav? Before we get to the Torah sources, look at source number 7 for a second. Source number 7 is from Maccabees 1. Maccabees are books written by people during the Hashmonai period, describing the history of the Hanukkah story, the history of the Hashmonai dynasty. Maccabees 1 was written by a Ephraim Jew. It's not considered part of our Tanakh, but poskim say you're allowed to read it in Hanukkah if you want to get the background of history. So this part of Maccabees, we're post the Hanukkah miracle. We're post the death of Yehuda Maccabee in the hands of the Greeks. Yehuda Maccabee was killed by the Greeks a couple years after the Hanukkah story. We're in the middle of the reign of Shimon HaMaccabee. Shimon, Yehuda's brother, takes over the leadership. He fights a war against the Greeks. He's victorious. He comes back to the Beis HaMikdash. This is what happens. And entered into it the 23rd day of the second month, Shimon HaMaccabee and whoever else was there entered into the Beis HaMikdash on the 23rd day of the second month, in the 171st year, with thanksgiving and branches of palm trees, with harps, cymbals, and vials, and hymns, and songs, because there was destroyed a great enemy out of Israel. What did Shimon HaMaccabee celebrate with in the Beis HaMikdash? Thanksgiving, harps, cymbals, vials, hymns, and songs, music, and branches of a palm tree. Lulavim. This is the 23rd day of the second month. It's the 23rd day of Cheshvan, or maybe 23rd day of the year. I forget how the months are calculated. What was he doing with a lulav during his victory procession, thanking Hashem for the defeat of the Greeks? With this background, let's look at a medrash. Look at source number 6. This is a medrash which many of you are probably familiar with, but hopefully will come to new light, at least become more real with this background. This is a midrash by Yikra Rabba. This is Chazal, straight up Chazal. We're going to start with the second paragraph, the bottom line of page 4. Amar Rabbi Avin. Amar Rabbi Avin, the previous part of the midrash is talking about the mitzvah of lulav. What is the lulav all about? Amar Rabbi Avin, Mashal l'shnayim sheniknasu etzel adayim. The fact that we take a dalam minim on Sukkis is analogous to two people who entered a court case. Less anan yadin man hu notzeach. We don't know when they walk out who wins. How do you know if you're standing outside who won the court case? And leman denasav bayan biyade, the one who carries a bayan in his hand, anan yadin du nitzkuya. We know the one who carries a bayan, a Greek word, that's the one who won. What is a bayan? Look in Jastrow. Jastrow wrote the first basic Talmudic dictionary. Bayan, those Greek letters spell bayon. What does the word bayon mean in Greek? A palm leaf, a palm branch. The one who's walking out of court with a palm branch, you know he was victorious in his court case. So what's the nimshal? Top of page 5. Kach Yisrael v'umos ha'olam. Baran mekatrigen l'tanei kadosh baruch hu b'Rosh Hashanah. The Jews and nations of the world have a court case in Rosh Hashanah. But less than Yad the Manatzach, we don't know who won afterwards. Ela b'mashi Yisrael yotzei milchnei Kadosh Baruch Hu v'lovein v'sorgein biyadon. The fact that the Jews leave Yom Kippur, Yom Nerayim, holding a lulav and esrog, anu yodin di Yisrael ino nitzkuya. We know that the Jews were victorious. Lefikach Moshe manzir the Yisrael to Omer lehem. Therefore Moshe exhorts the Jewish people and tells them, l'kachtem lachem b'yom harishon, take on the first day of Sukkot, kapos tamarim, take the dalad minim. So what's the Midrash saying? The Midrash has multiple reasons why we shake lulav and esrog on Sukkot. One of them is that it's a symbol of being victorious in a court case. The Jews and the non-Jews, and in Umos HaOlam, the Yetzirah, the Satan, some type of celestial battle is going on during the Yom Nerayim. We want a symbol to have confidence that we won the battle, that we're nechtam for a good year. And Hashem says, you want a symbol that you're nechtam for a good year, you're victorious in battle? Take lulav and esrog soon after Yom Kippur, soon after the Yom Nerayim. What's going on? Why did Bar Kokhba put a lulav on his coin? Why did Shimon HaMaccabee take a lulav on the 23rd day of Cheshvan? Because in the ancient world, Jews and non-Jews also, but particularly Jews, use a palm branch, use a lulav as a symbol of victory in war. That's the basis of this medrash. Otherwise, the medrash doesn't make any sense. What does it mean if you walk out of court holding a palm branch? We know you won. That was the custom in ancient times. Part of victory processions included holding a lulav, holding this tall palm branch. You walked, you paraded around the city with that. Everybody knew you were victorious. Medrash says that's how we know we're victorious in battle. Shimon HaMakabi took the lulav as a symbol that they were victorious in battle, integrated it into Hodah for Hashem. Hashem, thank you for being victorious. We're going to sing Mizmorim and Tehillim have a procession around with a palm branch, the same way we do on Sukkot, as a symbol of our victory, the way of thanking Hashem for our victory. What if Bar Kokhba used a palm branch on his coin? Because everybody who saw the coin would know that the palm branch, the lulav, is a symbol of Nitzachon and Milchama, and that's exactly what Bar Kokhba wanted to instill in his soldiers, to instill in the Jewish people. We are winning. We have the ability to beat the Romans. We're underdogs, we're outnumbered, we're outgunned, but we still have the ability to do it. We can be Goel Yisrael and rebuild the Beis HaMikdash, and the lulav becomes a symbol of that Nitzachon and Milchama. With this notion, a lot of, or some of the minhagim around the lulav and esrog becomes clear. We have the minhag to do hoshanos on Sukkot. And people take a lulav and esrog and they walk around the bima. Good. Where does minhag of hoshanos come from? The Mishnah records it. The Mishnah doesn't explain why we do it. It just says this is the minhag in the Beis HaMikdash. Once the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, it became the minhag in shuls to walk around the bima with the lulav and esrog. Why do we have a procession around the bima with the lulav and esrog? So on that Mishnah, which says you should do it, the Talmud Bavli doesn't have a reason why we do it. The Talmud Yerushalmi gives a reason. Look at source number 8. Each day you walk around the Mizbeach once. On Hoshana Rabbah, you walk around 7 times. That's what we do today in our shuls also. Amar Rabacha, Zecha D'Yericho. Why do we have a procession around the Bima, around the Aron, around the Mizbeach? It's a Zecha for Yericho. The Jews walked around Yericho once for the first 6 days. The seventh day, they walked around 7 times. They blew the shofars. The walls of Yericho fell down. My Inyan Shemitah, that's our Itzar Sinai. Why are we having a Zecha for Yericho on Sukkot? The various reasons have been suggested. One, I forgot who suggested it, just connects it to this medrash. The lulav is a military symbol. A lulav symbolizes war and victory in war. Therefore, it makes sense that once we're having our victory processions with our lulav, and we're saying, Hashem, we were victorious against the Yitzhara, we were victorious against Umos HaOlam on Yom Kippur, we were victorious in our din in Yom Kippur, that we should take that symbol of Nitzachon and use it as a zikr for our first major Nitzachon and Melchama, which is Yericho. And it's one level, it goes one step more. According to the Rambam, why do we take the Dal Aminim, and why do we sit in Nusaka? The Rambam says it's in order to open. Basically, it's Shabbat for Eretz Yisrael. In the agricultural year, we just finished the agricultural year, the farmer was supposed to have ingathered everything from ready ingathered everything from their field. The farmer knows that they have enough bounty to survive the cold winter. And now they're thanking Hashem for what they had. Sukkot is supposed to be thanking Hashem for Eretz Yisrael. That's why we go outside and sit in the sukkah. That's why the Dal Aminim, the Rambam says, are forms of Shevach for Eretz Yisrael. So what better usage of our Dal Aminim can we have than using it as a zecher for Yericho? Yericho, where we first entered Eretz Yisrael. That's one symbolism of the lulav and esrog. And also, Yericho is the first great military victory of the Jews in Eretz Yisrael. And we, as a simon nitzachon, we also walk around the bima with our lulav and esrog. But it's interesting. It's not just that we're thanking Hashem through having the lulav and esrog. What do we do? What do we do when we walk around the bima with our lulav and esrog? We say Hoshanos. What is the text of Hoshanos? What does the word Hoshana mean? Save us. It's a form of tefillah. Not only are we satisfied with what happened in the past, we have a simon nitzachon, Hashem, we were successful in battle, but we also use the lulav then as a form of tefillah. Just like we were successful in our previous battles, just like we were successful in Yericho, just like we were successful in our din on Yom Kippur, Hashem, please let us be equally as successful in all future battles that we have, spiritual battles, physical battles, military battles, whatever it is, And that's the Tefillah of Hoshana, taking a simon nitzachon, taking the symbol of victory in battle, and transforming it from not just the hodah, thanking Hashem, transforming it into a form of tefillah. Hashem, please keep this up for the future. We need you in order for these victories to continue. Just tangentially, what are the two psukim that we shake the lulav and esrog during Hallel? Hodah Hashem kitov, Thanksgiving, and Ana Hashem Hoshiyana, Hashem, please save us. The lulav is both a simon of nitzachon, of thanking Hashem, but also a symbol of tefillah. Hashem, please answer our tefillos and keep this up in the future. Agav, continuing on the same theme. So after Hoshana Rabbah, we circle the bima 7 times on Hoshana Rabbah. Then we have Simchas Torah. So in Simchas Torah is the minhagim of Simchas Torah are very late. You won't find the fact that we go around the bima in Simchas Torah at all. It dates back to the Middle Ages. It's not something which they practice in the times of the Gemara at all. Simchas Torah wasn't even supposed to exist, as you probably heard from Abemet. Simchas Torah is a diaspora holiday. It took a while for minhagim to develop and what to do on the last day of Sukkot. Now the Jews go back to Eretz Yisrael. We take all those minhagim the Jews did on the second day, we do it in Shmini Atzeres. But the minhagim of Simchas Torah are very late. If you read the Ashkenazi Makoros, from the medieval Ashkenazi Makoros, where Simchas Torah, where they describe the minhagim around Simchas Torah, take out the Sefer Torah, you go around the bima once, go around the bima 3 times, and that's it. A later minhag developed. I think it was the Arizal, was the first person to establish it. It says you go around the bima 7 times. You're supposed to have 7 hakafos. Now we don't have. Now we have 7 formal hakafos, but we dance around the bima multiple times within each hakafa. If I recall correctly, in Breuers, I'm not 100% sure this is true, but I'm almost positive in Breuers they really just do 1 hakafa each. But that's the original minhag. You do you walk around the bima 7 times with the Sefer Torah, and that's it. Why 7? So if you ask the Arizal, it has to do with the 7 spheros. There are ten mediums, the 10 spheros to which God interacts with the world. A lot of Kabbalistic practices correspond to the spheros. The lower 7 spheros are the main ones we're focusing on. 1 hakafa per sphera. And so if you look in your machzor, you'll find psukim, which have to do with the 7 spheros after each hakafa. Good. What are the 7 spheros? Let me see if I remember them. Chesed, Gevurah, Tiferes, Netzach, Yesod, Hod, and Malchus. Look in your machzor, after each hakafa, you'll find a pasuk that relates to one of those spheros. There are people in the world who are not mukubalim and still like the idea of having 7 hakafos. So why do we have 7 hakafos in Simchas Torah? So there's a very nice idea. He admits he made it up, but I forgot his name. He was a rabbi in Europe, then he moved to America, and he was the first rabbi in Pittsburgh, who wrote a book called Otzer Kol Minhagei Yeshurun. Just a treasury, a compilation, an anthology of different minhagim. So you look at the end of page 5, top of page 6. He explains why we have a why we go around the bima 7 times in Simchas Torah. He says, "Nagim lahakef is a bima zayin pam in Simchas Torah. We go around the bima 7 times in Simchas Torah. Hatam shu zeichor l'yiriko. We're continuing the theme of Sukkos. Zeichor to yiriko. Manin zayin ha'am alibo b'yom kaloso as a Torah. In Simchas Torah, we finish the Torah. We want people to remember. Ki haTorah hu tzitzur misgabo u'magin ba'ado. The Torah protects us. The Torah helps us be victorious in war. V'hi sh'amda l'avoseinu l'achid yiriko l'akosa. And the Torah is what helped us defeat Yericho. How did the Torah help us defeat Yericho? What's he referring to?
The
Aron, yeah. The Aron went around with them when they encircled Yericho, and presumably the Kolach of the Torah, the Kolach of the Aron, is what helped the walls of Yericho fall. So the day we finish the Torah, we want to continue this military imagery. We want to continue the imagery of we're in a war, we're attacking Yericho, thanking Hashem for the past, asking Hashem for help in the future. We want to remember, ultimately, what helps us be victorious in battle. Go back to the source. The first battle is Yericho. The Torah helps us be victorious. The Torah, the Aron, helps us be victorious in battle. And therefore, we want to remember that. So we danced around the bima with the Sefer Torah 7 times on the day when we finish Torah. It says it should be a motivator for us to continue learning in the coming year. One more symbolism, and then we'll wrap up. Look at source number 10. Dreshos Re-Ibn Shu'av. This is a Talmud of the Rashba, one of the Rishonim. He wrote very long Dreshos, which I hope he didn't give in public because they're many pages long, about various Yom Tovim. So he explains, he has multiple reasons why we shake the lulav also, not just take it, but he explains, this is one of the reasons why we shake the lulav as well. The Yesh Mefarshim after the ellipsis, Sharomei Zachag Vasuko, Shatshuva Mevia Lachag, V'Hasimcha K'misha Natzach V'Din. That we, on Sukkot, were experiencing Simcha, that we were victorious in our judgment, victorious in battle. V'Zeh Na'anua, K'matanaket Rumcha U'mena'anach. Not just do we carry around our lulav, but we shake it. Think about if you ever seen a military procession. I've never seen it, but people tend to shake their guns. I assume back in ancient times, people shook their spears when they were walking around in military parades. So, according to Dari Ibn Shu'ab, it's the same exact thing. While we shake the lulav in Esrog. Again, the Gemara says you shake the lulav as a form of tefillah. He's explaining it another level of symbolism. We're shaking the lulav in Esrog as a form of parading around. Yes, we were notzeach b'machama. We won our court case. And Hashem, please help us do it again in the future. So what's the lesson for us? The title was Lessons from Bar Kokhba. I don't really know. The lessons are the lessons will hopefully emerge from the Makaros organically. That sometimes having historical sources allows us to, sometimes it's not helpful at all. Sometimes it allows us to see Chazal, see our own Makaros in a more real life type of light, and it lets us highlight certain aspects that are already there, bring them to the fore, and make them really become alive in our minds. And I think, for me at least, I think that this notion that Sukkot, the lulav and esrog, is a military symbol, both for going to war and for victory in war, is something that wasn't as potent as it was last year as it is this year. I think for many of us who live in Chutz Laaretz, wars are somewhat distant from our consciousness. Wars happen other places around the world. They don't happen in America. They don't really happen in England. They don't happen in Australia. They don't really happen in many of the places where we live. They do happen in some places. They don't really happen in many of the places where we live. Unfortunately, Eretz Israel has a long history of wars. I think the most wars before here, it's up there in the number of lands the most wars have been fought in it over the course of history. And unfortunately, we're still fighting wars here in Eretz Israel in order to lay our stakes to our own land. And hopefully, this notion of a lulav and esrog as a military symbol, the symbol for nitzachon and milchama, the celestial milchama of our din and Yom Kippur, and also the real milchama, real physical milchama against our enemies, should be something which should be part of our consciousness, particularly here when we're celebrating Sukkot in Eretz Israel, many of us for the first time, for myself as a citizen for the first time. Thank you so much. I hope everybody has a great Sukkot.